introduce our main speaker for this evening, Alan Jay from San Diego.
Good evening. My name is Alan. I am an alcoholic. I want to thank you all for allowing me to speak tonight. It's very humbling, and I'll do my best to say the right things for those who need it. For all you that are new to this program, I commend you. You are courageous to walk through this door to admit that you have a disease of Alcoholics Anonymous, or alcohol. I mean, I knew from the very get-go that I had a chance to be an alcoholic. My parents were alcoholics. My mom was an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. Both had died from the disease. You know, I was born in New England, 1958. My parents. You know, there's a fine line between living and existing. You know, my mom, praise God to her, she was married to a very wealthy man. And at the time, the man couldn't give her children. And she met my dad at a party, and he says, "Yeah, I'll give you children." You know, little did he know that later on in life, she also gave him the disease of alcoholics and of alcohol. She was an alcoholic. You know, my dad should have been a farmer. He was a metal worker. He was a steel worker. He was a World War II veteran. He lost, his ship was missing out in the North Sea for many years, during World War II. It was frozen in. And, after World War II, he went into World War II because he was trying to find his brother. His older brother went into submarines, and his sub went down 4 days before the end of World War II. His sub was sunk by a Zero off the coast of Bali. And, I think my dad never really got over that. And it was one of his demons that he never dealt with. And being an alcoholic, we all have demons that we have to deal with. It's the man in the mirror that I always have to think about, you know. When he met my mom, you know, she could have been she could have done a lot of different things, but she chose to have children. If it wasn't for her want and desire for children, I wouldn't be here. My brother wouldn't be here, you know. And during that childhood, my mom would write checks out of the back of the book to the liquor store. And she would spend money and go to the liquor store and buy booze. And my dad would write checks to the home mortgage. And that happened too many times. And it was like we ended up losing the house. You know, the Jewels. My last name is Jewel. We lived on Pearl Street. You know, so it's kind of ironic that happened. And so here I was, like 9 years old, and I don't know any better. I'm just a kid, you know. And I take my goldfish in my lap, and we went off, and we found my parents had found this trailer, you know, in this trailer park. It was a really nice trailer park, and we bought the trailer. And when we went to go get the trailer, they moved it to a different trailer park. It was at the end of a dirt road, past the train tracks, and huddled around with a bunch of other trailers, you know, and it was dirty all the time and things like that. And my parents were at the peak of their alcoholism, and my mother would yell at my dad. My dad would beat my mom, and this would go on for days. This would go on for weeks. It went on for years that this would happen, you know. And I felt bad for my neighbors because the next trailer was no closer than that window away. And it was an interesting childhood, you know. There was a lot of turmoil and things like that. And there were nights where I would come home and my dad would be sitting in a chair with a shotgun in his lap. I'm not sure if he was going to shoot me or what he was doing there, but he was very sick. He was a very, very sick man. And I'd come home and sometimes my mom would be a bloody mess. And it was like, and he'd end up in jail, he'd end up in institutions. He was heading down that road we all talk about, you know. We always say that, jail's institution or death. Well, my dad did all three, and he ended up dying from alcoholism. I left the trailer when I was 18 years old. I had gotten a job. I was working as a cook in a restaurant, dishwasher in a restaurant. A year later, I was running a restaurant. So I had natural talent. I was a chef. So I was going to go to culinary school. And one morning I wake up. My dad's got my bag of grass because I like to smoke pot. You know, I was a big pot head, man. I loved everything about it. I loved rolling joints. I loved smoking it. You know, I love the whole culture of it, you know, the underground culture. And my dad wakes me up, and he's got my bag of weed. He says, what is this? He says, this is what he did. He found my Gourmet Guide to Grass, which was a book. And he goes, what are you going to be? What are you going to be? I'm going to be a gourmet dad. So a couple of months later, I was off. And 3 months after high school, I moved out, and I took my brother with me. And I can remember as clear as day as we had this treasure trunk that I kept all my stuff in. And I can remember clear as day as my mom is begging me not to leave. And she's just begging me, and she's pulling on the other end of the, as I'm walking down the stairs of the trailer, she's trying to convince me not to move out. You know, and I said to my brother, I said, I need a roommate. You're it. And so I lived together, and I ran that restaurant. I was 17, 18 years old when I was running a restaurant. I was tending bar, and I was doing all this other stuff. So I had a natural talent in the restaurant business. I love the restaurant business. It's, you can travel anywhere in the world and be a chef. And I love to eat, as you can see. You know? And, my wife doesn't. She's like, I never cook. I never can ever cook. You know, and... It was like when I lived in that town, Wallingford, Connecticut, it was like everybody just partied. That's all they did was party. Everything was a party. And I fit right into that group. I had a friend named Fruit. Everyone had their nicknames. Mine was Noodles because of one night. You might understand why I was called Noodles, you know. And everyone had a nickname. There was Fruit. There was Duck. There was Bubaloo. There was a lot of us. And we used to just smoke pot and just hang out at his house because he had gotten my – I found this guy, Dave. He was my in metal shop. He was my my locker mate, you know. And it was like, and he ended up. I was dating a girl, and he ended up getting her girlfriend pregnant. And so that's how I got in there. And I found a group of friends that I could really relate to, you know. And we'd smoke dope out in the woods, and do all sorts of stuff, do camping, and I mean, it was you know what? It was a good time. It was like a good time until it wasn't a good time. And so I went off to culinary school, and I was working in the Dunes Club over the summer, and I got a call from my brother. He says, "Mom's got you jaundice." I was like, "Oh, great! The bitch has got cirrhosis of the liver. Let her die." And that's what I thought. And it was like it turned out to be cancer of the pancreas. And so I went home, and I skipped a year in culinary school. I went home, and I took care of my mom. My dad was still in his disease during this whole time. And it was the best 9 months I ever spent with my mom. I mean, I was really, really happy that I had done that. And I really got to know her. I mean, I love my mom, you know. So after that, I went back to school, and there I still was in the disease. I was still partying, still drinking, still smoking dope, and working in a restaurant business. And I had a girlfriend, and her nickname was Fifi LaRue. And so Fifi LaRue and I, we were just crazy in Providence, and we just do crazy shit. And I remember going to this bar one time, and we were already lit. And I go into the bar, and it's near the beach and that kind of stuff. And I find the staircase, and I go up the staircase, and I walk into this, and it's another bar. There's nobody there. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is perfect. So there I was, just about ready to climb over the bar, and the bouncer grabs me. And it's like, oh, we got thrown out of there. And it's like, you know, on the way home, she sideswiped several cars. It was a crazy time in my life, you know. And then I get a phone call from my uncle, the youngest of the family. And it's, your dad's missing. We can't find your dad. Your aunt just died. So there's Randy and my dad, who used to fight like cats and dogs. When I was a little kid, they used to Randy come over, they'd be sober, and they start drinking, and then they start beating on each other. I mean, so it was sort of the point that my brother and I would leave the house. And I remember seeing, we had this cobbler bench. My dad had, you know, Randy underneath the cobbler bench, and he's going like this, you know, and they're fucking killing themselves. Jesus Christ. And so... My Uncle Jimmy, who's the younger of the family, he doesn't seem to have the disease. He's a Marine, but then again, they think that he's a half-brother, so he might be a half-jewel. So, you know, he's one of those guys that can kind of flip a switch, can take it or leave it. You know, he was former Marine, three tours in Nam, that kind of guy, you know. I love him to death. He's the only one that's still alive in that, in my dad's side of the family. But there he is. He's got these big ears, and I see him in the squad car, and there was snow on the ground, and you know, I get that call, and he said, just stay put, and I'm like, oh, fuck that shit. I was an hour and a half away. I got in my car, and I drove there, and I found out that my dad had passed away, and he had crawled into an abandoned trailer and died. So, you know, so basically I was kind of set free from everything there. I didn't have any connections except my brother, and he was getting married. And during that time, we took care of my dad's affairs. My brother and I and my two uncles are sitting side by across the table and stuff like this, and we're fighting. My brother reaches over and grabs my shirt, you know. Here we are separating the estate with a bottle of Jack Daniels, you know. It's like, you know, you can have this table, you can have that table, and you know, we're going to sell the trailer for $5,000 or whatever. There really wasn't much of an estate, you know. But my dad did have a business, you know. It was the business of being an alcoholic. And it was a business that was inherited to both me and my brother. It was it's the business you don't want to inherit, you know. And so during that time, I made plans to leave, and I ran away. And I bought a 72 Chevy van. I piled in with a couple of girls. We went to Aspen, Colorado for a while. And I ended up working in Colorado in the restaurant business and hotel business, but the alcohol and the drugs were still there. But, you know, it was really funny because I remember these cooks I used to work with, and they would be shooting shots in the morning and drinking beer all day long during the summertime. And I'm like, oh, that's not me. No way. I had alcoholism down to a science. You know, I knew what to eat, what not to eat before I went to bed, what to drink, what not to mix with drinks. Whiskey goes good with beer. Vodka, mixed drinks don't go with anything. You know, and wine, you can have a good, you know, you can have brandies and wines and cognacs after you drink wine, that kind of stuff. Because I was in the hotel business. I mean, I just love that business because it was always a party. I mean, everywhere you went, and the drinks were free. And here I was, a kid that grew up in a trailer park, and I was like, "Going, I'm living the high life, you know. I'm living with the rich and famous, you know. Except I'm serving them, you know." But you know, I've drank Dom Perignon, I've drank Louis XIV, I've drank Cristal, I've drank, you know, every kind of whiskey you can ever imagine, you know, and that was the lifestyle I was living, and it was good, but the problem was that I could not control it. I could not stop once I started. You know, granted, I go home, on the way home, I'd stop off and get a burrito. Here, when I was here in San Diego, I'd stop off on Washington Street and get a burrito after leaving work and spending some time in the bar and that kind of stuff, and I made sure I didn't wake up with a hangover, you know. He says, I had a full stomach, and I took a couple of Advils before I went to bed, you know. But that was my life, you know. And you know, and my dad had always said to me, son, you're big enough and ugly enough to take care of yourself. So, and that was a horrible thing to say to me, you know. It's like, I'm big enough, okay, but I'm ugly? You know, so I always had a problem with women. I could never find the girlfriend. It was like, and I was one of those desperate guys that women just want to be near, you know. It was like I had no confidence in myself. I had a very low self-esteem. You get a few drinks in me, and I'm like Superman, you know. I'm okay, you know. And when I was in Colorado, I got a DUI, you know. And it's the only DUI I got. And I was leaving Colorado, and I was going to come to California, and my punishment was mucking stalls at the state fair. I'm like, oh, fuck this shit. I'm out of here, man. I'm leaving California, man. So today I'm a wanted man in Colorado. And it's like, you know, it's kind of like, this is like 1983, so I don't know. I think maybe I might have to go back and do my amends on that. But you think? So, you know, my life was spiraling. I got a call from my brother, you know, and he is crying his eyes out. He's bawling his eyes out. He had the worst part of it. My dad, when he was playing baseball, he was playing Little League, and the manager or the coach wouldn't play him. So you know what my dad did to him? Said he goes, I'm going to show that coach. He goes, take your uniform off. We're leaving. So he made my brother take his uniform off in the dugout, and they left. And that was the kind of dad I had. He wasn't thinking. I mean, he just didn't think right, you know. Crazy rebel from Virginia, you know. And so that, you know, so I had that low self-esteem, and I just, you know, and I loved to get high because it was just an escape. And I had gotten every job I ever wanted except one. And that job, I think I took a piss test. So I didn't pass the test. And I was like, oh, no, shit. So I guess I got to stop smoking dope. So that was easy to quit. And then my alcoholism just really kicked in. And it was like crawling across the border from Mexico and doing crazy shit. And knock on wood, I didn't get a DUI. I had that down pretty packed. I was a safe drunk driver. I remember getting pulled over. I had a beer between my legs, and I was just about ready to crack that baby, man. And it was like... I was glad I didn't crack that baby because I was already a little bit lit. And I remember over here off the freeway, and I got pulled over. I had this car that I bought from this European guy. You know, some Europeans come over here and they spend the summer and they buy a car. So I bought this 67 Park Lane, and nicknamed it Das Boot. And that car was awesome, man. It had like a 390 in it. It was a cool car. And I'd be smoking my pipe in there, and I get pulled over, and the cop's doing the old light and make me walk the line, and I'm walking the line, and I look up, and he's looking at my feet. Fuck, he's looking at my feet, so he's not looking at me. So as I'm doing the line thing, I'm walking down the line, I'm looking straight ahead, and I ended up, by the grace of God, I ended up passing that DUI test. And then another time I was down at PB over near Bacon Street, and I was at the end of the Coronado Avenue there, and I was parked there, and there's a no parking sign there, and I'm just sitting there, and I'm kind of buzzed. I'm, you know, and I'm just blocks away from my house, and the cop comes up to me, and he goes, what's that sign say? It says no parking. He says, oh, okay, is that your car? Yeah, that's my car. Looks in the car, and a pipe sticking out. I'm like, oh. So he couldn't arrest me. He confiscated my pipe because I didn't have any grass. I didn't have any more pie. He checked the car out. The car was clean, but I ended up going to detox, and that was an awakening experience, going to detox, and it was and I had to walk home that day from downtown all the way to Coronado. It's like, you know, years ago I used to hitchhike all over the place, but I really had to think about what was going on in my life, and I just. You know, and then things started taking turn for the better, I guess. I was catering, and I had actually met a gentleman there when I was catering, and he ended up being my sponsor. And but a long story short, oh shit, I still got plenty of time. How much time do I have? Long story long. So I'm doing some catering, and I had my own catering business. I had met this woman. I was working at the Hotel Del Coronado, and during my interview, I had this lady was sitting there with another gentleman, and her name was Anne Marie, and it was like so. I was working at the Hotel Del, and I was working up in the Crown Room. Just nice. If anyone ever go to a hotel, it's a nice place. You know, I've worked in all nice hotels. I worked at the Westgate. I worked at Sheraton. I worked at Torrey Pines. I worked at a place in the Rocky Mountains where The Shining was written. Stephen King actually went there and spent the winter there, and he wrote The Shining at this place called Stanley Hotel in Estes Park. If you ever get there, it's really nice. And so I'm working at the Hotel Del. I get the job, and I'm a server in the morning, and this bubbly person comes walking through, and she's going, do this, do this, do this. And I stop her, and I go, good morning. Good morning, Anne-Marie. You know, and little did I know so many years later that we would cross paths again. You know, and it was like I ended up working down in the hotel, in the Prince of Wales room, where he had a tuxedo on, and we served everything, a rack of lamb, and tableside cuisine, and here I was, the kid from the trailer park, you know, so I was important, I was doing something with my life, you know, but I still had that craziness going on. And so I was working in the Prince of Wales room, and we used to do tableside cuisine and that kind of stuff, and flambés. We used to burn the house down and that kind of stuff. So it was a lot of fun. And then years later, I was doing a lot of catering, and I was down at the convention center. And I stuck in the back door like I always do. I always sneak in the back door, you know, concerts, hotels, and places where I shouldn't be. You know, I always go through the back door. Even today I'm in sales and I still go through the back door because I just feel comfortable going through the back door, you know. I've only had one guy actually throw me out on my ass, but that was kind of funny. So there's this woman and she's bouncing around and she's got her name tag. And I walk up to her and I go, "Oh, hey, Marie, how are you? How you been?" This was like years ago. We had both left the Hotel Del, and she said, I'm good. And then her friend came walking up, and she had a name tag on, too, and I introduced, I knew she forgot my name. I said, "Oh, my name's Alan." And so that night, my life had changed that night. It really did. It changed for the better. And we went out to eat, and she passed in flying colors. Sarah was 35. I still wasn't married at 30, 32, 33. At all, you know, was never married at 33. And never really anything serious or anything like that. And we had dinner that night, and she passed in flying colors. Because I had always had those girls who used to take advantage of me. You know, they drained me for my money, and then I was useless, you know. And so, you know, first she said... I don't have any money. I don't get paid until Friday. We're going to go out and get something to eat. I said, "Okay, check." She says, "I got some money for the tip." Check. You know, and it turned out that she had her own house, too. Check, check. She's like, she was from La Jolla. She was from La Jolla. I was like, check, 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 you know. Here I am thinking, you know, she's got money. She's got a house. She even works for the government. so she's got a pension too, you know. So it's like, check, 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 check. And so, you know, we ended up dating about a year and a half later. Here I am asking her dad to marry if I can marry her daughter. And here's her dad is so funny. He goes, "Well, I'm not really the one to ask." I said, "Yeah, she already said yes." And he said, "No, you got to talk to Sarah." And that was the mom. Oh my God! If you ever met Sarah, she was like, "It's funny. She passed away 2 years ago on April 15th, so she didn't have to pay her taxes." So we have a picture of her in our house right now, and it was really funny. Last year, we got this big picture framed, and I'm walking through Michael's, and I'm going, "This is my mother-in-law." You know, this picture of my mother-in-law is like this big, like that big, you know? And it was just, you know, it's just kind of an inside joke. It's like, "That's your mother-in-law." Yeah. So Sarah and I ended up getting along pretty well. But we ended up scheduling to get married, and me and my sponsor T, who was working with us as a bartender, we used to do kosher parties, and we had a good friend named Stan Gelfand who used to do a lot of functions and stuff like that. So we do parties for him and things like that, bar mitzvahs, weddings, you name it, we did it, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, there was a lot of booze, a lot of wine. We went home with a lot of booze and that kind of stuff, and a lot of booze. And I hooked it up so he would do our wedding, you know. And my brother still was in his disease, and he was spiraling out of control. And we kept in touch, and I knew he was hurting. And so he flew out here for our wedding. And that day when he flew out, we went to Shelter Island, and we made a pact. I said, this alcohol ends here, right here. This ends here. He goes, "I'm going into rehab. And you know, my alcoholism disease wasn't as bad as his, but then again, it could have been. And I was getting married, and I didn't want my family to see that ugly disease. You know, and my wife, she, you know, God bless her, I remember, she's like asking me, what do you like to drink? Oh, Jack Daniels. I really like Jack Daniels, you know, but, and I could see right through it, because when I was leaving her house, I was sneaking off and getting little nips and buying a six pack on the way home, and I was still drinking, even though how much she loved me, and even that wasn't going to fix it. So my brother and I made that pact, and he left the wedding and went into rehab. And so 3 months later, you know, T and I talked. He said he was clean and sober for 2 years. I'm like, oh, well, he's a test dummy. So, you know, and test dummy for me. Yeah, if he can do it, I can do it. You know, and that's the miraculous thing about AA is you know, it doesn't matter if you're from Yale or jail. You can get sober. You can get clean. You know, and if you work the steps, you work the program, you get a sponsor, that's the big thing, man, because your burdens are so heavy. The past of your life is just so heavy. I like sponsoring young people, you know what, because they don't have a lot of baggage, you know. I sponsor a bunch of young people, it's like, let's do your fifth step, you know, let's do your fourth step. And it's like, really? You know? And sometimes the old timers, you know, I sponsor some old timers, and they just can't look themselves in the mirror. And that's the big thing, is you got to be able to look yourself in the mirror. You got to look at your faults, your defects, and that's what I had to do. I had to look at my character defects most of all, the low self esteem and things like that. See, I was one of those guys that read the books, and I went to PMA sessions, and you know, I went to church, and I was just couldn't find the right combination, you know, until I walked into these rooms, and finally I felt like I belonged somewhere, you know. Remember Fruit, my friend Dave, where I used to belong somewhere, you know. We were partying and stuff like this, and it was like, I belonged somewhere, you know. And so, you know, I met T and I got together, and we used to go down to, API? API was a big meeting over on Thursday, and I went in there a couple times drunk, or I had beer on my breath, or that kind of stuff, you know, but I wanted it. I really wanted it. Just like every job I've ever gotten, everything I've ever wanted, I've been able to get, you know, and I believe that I have a higher power. You know, and here's a couple examples of my higher power. Here I was in Denver, Colorado, and I was living at the YMCA. I was down to my last $50. I was 2,000 miles away from home, and I had no one at home to go to. And there I was. There was a chapel downstairs, and I went downstairs, and I got on my knees, and I prayed for a job. And I went in, looked in the paper the following morning, and there was a job in Longmont at a country club. They hired me on the spot. And it was a tip job, so I was getting money in my pocket right away. And it was like, and there was a higher power involved in that, you know. But I got in my way in there. I said the wrong thing to the wrong person, and it ended up being the manager's kid that I told off, or I said something bad to him, and I was out of my ass in 3 days. But I had a fistful of money, you know. So I knew that there was a higher power, you know. And on the way to California, I'm driving through Truckee, California, you know, where all those people are, you know, 10 minutes, thank you. And I'm driving through Truckee, California. And it's snowing. And I'm driving my 1972 Chevy van, and I'm cruising along. I've got my brandy between my legs, and I'm just cruising along, coming around this bend. And this truck comes flying by. And it was like, we came so close, I could smell his cigarette. It was like, I almost died that night. I almost died on that freeway. In our mountain road. And I had to pull over, and I'm like, well, what would they say? What will my brother do? Because it was just my brother and some distant cousins and that kind of stuff in my life. You know, I was out seeking adventure, you know, coming to California. Going to make $1 million, you know. Money's not everything, but it sure helps. So, my wife is she's been a big part of my life and my sobriety. Obviously, I've been married 25 years to the same person, and I've been sober for 25 years. October 1st, 1993 is when I got clean. And, And you know what? I don't say that to brag. I am just a product of the system. You know, I just worked the steps. There was a period of where I went on a sabbatical from AA, but I still hung out with people that were still in the program. And I still talked to my brother and that kind of stuff. But I got real busy. I had a family. I had two boys and a full-time job in sales. And all of a sudden, things were starting to get kind of crazy again, and I couldn't figure it out. And God put this man in my life. Unfortunately, it was through a death of his spouse. Friend of his spouse had died, a friend of the family. She had went in for a cyst behind her heart, and a doctor nicked the pancreas going in, and she went into a thyroid storm. And this poor man watched his wife wither away to 22 months. And I went and visited her once, and I couldn't do it because I remember when my mom passed away, because she was in a coma for 30 days. And it was not a fun thing. And I remember I couldn't go in there, but I remember Jim had a drinking problem, and that he was an alcoholic. And I knew that my turn was coming after she passed away. And sure enough, we get about a year and a half later, we get a knock on the door, and there's Jimmy, his son. My dad's going to the hospital. I need a place to stay. So, and I'm like going, okay, you can stay here, no problem. And, I'll go visit him in the hospital. He'd be pushing that morphine button. Oh, yeah, what's your pain level? 10, And he was in there for a couple of weeks, and I ended up taking over his finances, and we took care of his kid. But when he got out, he went on a raging binger, and he just wanted to die. And we ended up through people in the program, I seeked advice, we were able to find. We found out that if we put Jimmy in the system, that he'd be gone in the system. So the only thing that we could do for them was to take Jimmy away, and we sent him away to his aunt's house. Meanwhile, Jim was on his bender, and I go through his house, and I'd sweep his house, and I'd do 12-step, and he ended up in the hospital, and he crashed three cars, dumped his motorcycle with his kid on the back, and lost a car, like you lost a car. That was kind of funny. He lost a car, and I had to find his car. But all in all, we ended up getting him through it, and I ended up back in the rooms of AA, helping him, helping myself, which put me into another position that God had put me in that position, because there was other challenges coming up in my life that he needed me to be in this program, and he needed me to... See, AA, I did all 11 steps. I never did a 12-step. I never 12-stepped anybody. I got busy. I got busy in life. And there were certain circumstances in my life where people were putting that my higher power put those people in there. And I'm so grateful for my higher power and those things that had happened. Because today, I am... You know what? I'm sitting there, and I'm going through this. We're going through this shit. And we're going through this stuff, and a buddy of mine, Randy, who's got like 10 years sobriety, and he says to me, we're talking in a men's meeting. I got a great men's group, that we do dinners on Thursdays and that kind of stuff. I the same guys that do the jelly donut meeting over on. This is a little plug for you guys. Every Saturday at 10:30 a.m., there is a men's jelly donut meeting. And I'm looking at my guys at 5107 that go there, 5 minutes, okay, that go there, and they say, because I'm always talking about this men's jelly donut meeting, but there's a lot of great sobriety there. So if you guys skip the cartoons, come over to 5107 on Waring Road on Saturday morning at 10:30 a.m. and get some sobriety. Okay, plug over. So anyway, there's, I forgot where the hell I was. Hey, the people in AA, I've gotten lawyers through AA, I've gotten doctors through AA, I know pharmacists, I know professional pharmacists, I know lawyers, and I know ditch diggers, and I know electricians, and you know what? This AA is better than Angie's List, I swear to God, and you can trust these people, It's like I'm a proud member of AA, and I just love it when I'm at parties and stuff like that, and people go, "You don't drink?" It's just, "I'm an alcoholic." And they go, "Well, they react two ways. Either like step away like they're gonna, they either understand, or they kind of step away like they're gonna catch a disease, It's like, I'm like, get it, And I respect anybody who can drink like a normal person, but once I start, I don't stop. But I'm a functioning drunk. I wasn't a, you know, I don't went on bingers and shit like that, but, and you know, I went to work drunk, and I worked at the Marriott up there in La Jolla, and me and this other chick used to drink a whole bottle of Jordan Chardonnay at lunch, you know, in between pouring the customer's glass and pouring their glass. You know, Jordan, a bottle of Jordan Chardonnay is $40 in a restaurant, you know, and they just never caught on. They just, I just never caught on to that shit, you know. And I was always friends with the bartender and that kind of stuff, but... But, you know, I am very grateful for AA. If you're new to the program, find a sponsor you can deal with, one that's not, that, you know, one that, that you can trust, and have them work the steps, you know. Have them work the steps, read the book, go to meetings. You know, I go to, still 25 years, I still go to four meetings minimum a week. You know, you'll find me here, you'll find me 5107, you'll find me, and then I associate with just alcoholics. You know, a lot of my best friends are alcoholics. My best friend is an alcoholic. My brother is an alcoholic. You know, and the lineage, the things that I get from this program are just unbelievable. And I think my time is just about up, isn't it? Yeah?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. 2 minutes. So the future looks bright for me. I gotta wear shades, and I have a great job. I work in sales and I work in the restaurant business. I still work in the restaurant business, which I missed greatly. But the hours just really suck, and they don't pay any money. So now I walk in the back doors of kitchens and have chefs scream at me and throw knives and that kind of stuff. And I've been pretty successful, you know. And there's so many opportunities you can have if you're not drinking. You know, if you don't believe in the God, believe in the power of AA. You know, I've always believed in God. I've always believed that there was something greater to me because I'm a simple person. You know, I like to keep things simple. It's just easier to figure out the stars and all this other stuff, or how a baby is made. Not the making, but the baby is made. You know, you just kind of think about that. What happens in a woman's womb is just unbelievable. That's my son. He too is a member of AA. The apple does not fall far from the tree. You know, I'm very proud of him, what he's done and what he's come through, you know. But it is a hereditary disease. It is a family disease, that it's the family business you don't want. That's all I got.